The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at kfai.org. Non-commercial, community powered radio. Thursday at this time, it's the Northern Sun Radio News with Don Olson and Dave Gudnick. And Dave, you're going to start off things today?
Yeah, thanks, Don. And I got three general things I want to cover. The first one is the briefest, but I want to tie what's happening in Ukraine to part two, which is mostly about Iran and Trump and our war on Iran. And Ukraine, of course, has been somewhat pushed off the front page, but there's definitely a serious war going on there. And we're going to hear from Professor John Mearsheimer, distinguished political science and historian at the University of Chicago, with some comments about Ukraine. But by way of introduction, I want to point out two parallels. One, that is, between the war on Iran and the war on Ukraine, or in Ukraine. The war in Ukraine, Don and I have characterized for many, many times as a war aimed at Russia, aimed at regime change, weakening Russia. And the primary vehicle for this long-term campaign has been NATO expansion, but it's also been accompanied by the most extreme economic sanctions ever seen against Russia and related individuals and companies. And the parallel strategy is that we have been also making war or some way attacking Iran really since 1953, when we overthrew the popular Mossadegh government, democratically elected, who wanted to claim oil resources for the Iranians rather than for the Brits in the U.S. And, of course, we overthrew him, and then the Iranians got their own country back and their own government back, because civil society had been largely suppressed by the dictator we supported over there. The rebellion arose through the clerics, and that's when we had the 1979 Iranian rebellion, which threw out the Shah, and our war then took a different tone. We actually started immediately planning on attacking Iran through Iraq and sponsored Saddam Hussein in a long-term war that killed hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, including through chemical warfare, ingredients supplied by the United States. So the point is, the parallel is that both of these wars are a result of long-term U.S. expansion and a drive to weaken and achieve regime change against the adversary, either Iran, been going on for decades, or Russia, been going on since the Cold War ended in 1990. The other parallel, much more briefly, I want to say, is that as a result of being involved heavily in the new modern form of warfare with drones and missiles, we are actually coming up against very clear limits to our abilities, to our armaments and so on, because of being overextended in both places. So there's a very direct military connection as well.
It's so funny that Trump, again last night, and so many other people in favor of the U.S. war on Iran, they say that Iran has been our enemy for 47 years. Well, they only go back to 1979. And Dave, you have just brought it back to 1953, when the U.S. CIA and the MI6 of the United Kingdom overthrew the democratically elected. So there is a reason why there's been hostility from Iranians towards the U.S. It's a whole history there, which is conveniently ignored by most media in this country.
Let's hear briefly from Mearsheimer, and he's speaking at first about Trump, who tends to blame anyone but himself for the problems we're in. But, you know, blame Europe, blame Russia, blame someone, blame Zelensky even on occasion. So let's hear for about 5 minutes from Professor John Mearsheimer.
It's just not in the cards. And any European naval forces that we add on to an attack force are not going to help us get through the strait. It just doesn't matter. My second point is that what's going on here is that President Trump is preparing to blame the Europeans for the disaster in the Gulf. President Trump is not going to want to take responsibility for this. We all know how President Trump operates. Even though he started this war, and the Europeans had nothing to do with starting it, and even though President Trump can't win it and the Europeans don't matter in terms of helping us win it, he's going to blame them. It's President Trump, it's always somebody else's fault. And that's what's going on here. So I find this hardly surprising. Whether NATO remains intact as a formal institution, I don't know. But as a meaningful military alliance, I think it's effectively dead.
Let's take a look at what that would mean here. If President Trump withdrew under the current circumstances, meaning that we didn't have a coherent and cooperated and coordinated end of NATO and said, let's just draw this thing down and, you know, part his friends kind of thing, but you just say in a tantrum, all right, y'all, I'm sick and tired of y'all, we're just leaving. And who knows what that physically would look like. And I mean, it would be a monumental move to get troops out and all that kind of thing. But the damage, I think, psychologically and relationally between the United States and Europe, can you just take, you know, what are some of the potentials that could come from such a ripped up divorce on a spur of the moment?
Well, it could permanently damage transatlantic relations. They're already poisonous. And, you know, lots of people think there's a possibility that President Trump may turn things around, or we can sit out the remaining almost 3 years. And then at that point in time, we'll have a new president and you can fix things. I think that's hardly likely at all. But you know what's very interesting here, Danny? In the old days, what we used to focus on when we talked was the Ukraine war. And we hardly talk about Ukraine anymore because the Iran war is front and center. But as you and I both know, the Ukraine war is going on. And the Ukrainians are in deep trouble. And they're in more trouble than ever because this war is having a deleterious effect on the Ukrainians' war effort. Less weaponry is now flowing from the United States to Ukraine because it's flowing to the Middle East. Furthermore, the Russians are getting wealthier and wealthier because they're selling more and more oil on world markets because we've greatly reduced sanctions on Russia. So the Russians, who you and I would agree were in the catbird seat in the Ukraine war before the Iran war started, are even in better shape today. So at some point, I think what's going to happen here is that Ukraine is going to clearly lose on the battlefield. The Russians are clearly going to be in the driver's seat. And that is going to have huge consequences for NATO. Because again, the question is going to be, who's responsible for this catastrophe? And President Trump is going to say, it's not me, it's the Europeans. And as you know, President Trump has been reducing the American commitment to Ukraine over time. And he has been saying the burden of dealing with Ukraine is on the shoulders of the Europeans. So he, in a very important way, has positioned himself to blame the Europeans and to blame NATO for what is coming down the pike in Ukraine. So I would imagine that sometime, probably in the late summer, you're going to have this 1-2 blow where it's manifestly clear that the war in Iran is a significant defeat for the United States, and the United States and its European allies have been defeated in the Ukraine war. And this is going to put President Trump in a terrible position. And my point to you is he's going to try to blame the Europeans. He's going to try to blame NATO. And this is going to just make a disastrous situation in terms of transatlantic relations even worse.
Okay, that's Colonel Daniel Davis interviewing Professor John Mearsheimer, and we're going to be returning to Mr. Mearsheimer because he talks a lot about Iran and Trump's policies there, which we have quite a bit more to say on. So, Don, anything so far you want to add?
No, not right off. That was all very interesting. So it's Mearsheimer's, as Daniel Davis are keen observers.
All right. Well, now to get into the Iran complete mess, one of the things I think is becoming clear all around the world is that Trump is impulsive, poorly informed, and you could say quite a few other things, but he certainly got us into an extremely difficult situation where he probably would like to get out but doesn't know how. And so we have a kind of directionless dinosaur of the United States military and financial machine thrashing about. And the conversation about it has been unreal, to give it one word, because they've had like eight different reasons for going to war in Iraq. There was a regime change, which I believe they expected to be able to accomplish within a few days, and that was a complete failure. Then there was uranium enrichment, which prior to the war, Iran had actually agreed to more limits than prior circumstances. But we, of course, betrayed them by starting the war right in the middle of negotiations. So there went uranium enrichment. Now they have more motivation to get a nuclear bombs for their own self-protection. Then we were going to support the protesters, which is nonsense, and the number of deaths was grossly exaggerated, and quite a few of them were infiltrated by Mossad and the like. So forget supporting protesters. That's hypocritical. Now, of course, the main thing is, good grief, we have to open the strait. That's certainly a foremost objective. None of these mentions oil. None of this mentions Israel. And so this is why I call the conversation somewhat unreal. And then just a couple days ago, Secretary Rubio described his objectives, completely different from everything I just said. First was destroy the Iran Air Force. Well, they didn't have much of an air force, but they got a heck of a drone and missile capacity. Second one, he said, was destroy the Iran Navy. Well, they don't really have a big navy like we do, but they do have lots of submarines and submersible drones and things that are definitely threatening the waterway there, and they still have lots of that. Then he was going to, third one from Rubio was severely diminish their missile capacity. Well, they probably have, but as is well known, most of their missile capacity is buried under many meters of granite, which cannot be penetrated by any of our missiles or bombs and stuff. So it's extremely unlikely that we've eliminated their missile capacity, despite the hyperbolic statements by Trump and Hegseth and so on. And last thing, listed by Rubio, his objectives was destroy their missile factories. Well, I kind of just covered that and somewhat redundant. But the point is that we have a mixed bag of different claimed motivations, starting with the failed regime change and starting with the failure to accommodate on uranium enrichment, and no mention of oil, no mention of Israel. So this is why I think we have to get some clarity. And I'm going to return to Mearsheimer to talk about the Iran war. He's again being interviewed by Colonel Daniel Davis.
And I think that there's no question he would do that.
We got to find the right place here. Hold on.
If their conditions are met, then they'll join in. I mean, what do you make of just the fact that it appears anyway that President Trump read this headline and then made this comment publicly, and what may be going on behind the scenes?
Who knows? I mean, to be honest, who knows what he's thinking? You know, sometimes you listen to him talk and you think he's a mad king. Other times you think he just misunderstands what the Iranians are saying. But number one, the Iranians have made it clear they're not interested in a ceasefire. Any more than the Russians are interested in the ceasefire in Ukraine. We keep going down this road. The Iranians would be crazy to agree to a ceasefire. They're in the driver's seat. And from their point of view, the best thing to do is to continue to wage the war vigorously. All this talk about, you know, we're on the verge of some sort of agreement, we're going to end this war in 2 or 3 weeks. I don't know what he's talking about. And furthermore, there are just a number of big dimensions that have to be dealt with if you're going to settle this war. For example, what's going to happen with economic sanctions? Are we going to end economic sanctions on Iran? What about a nuclear agreement? We don't have a JCPOA anymore. We've just been engaged in this war. You have hardliners in charge in Iran. What are they going to agree to in terms of nuclear enrichment? Are they going to let IAEA inspectors back in? What's going to happen with the Strait of Hormuz? What's going to happen with American military bases in the region? You know, the Iranians have demanded that not only American military bases be removed from the region, but they've also said that American companies, American businesses have to leave the region. And they've been targeting those businesses inside the various Gulf states. So all these issues are on the table. And you can rest assured the Iranians are going to drive a hard bargain. They'd be crazy not to. They're dealing with Israel and the United States, two genocidal states that have decided to put their gun sights on Iran. The United States and Israel represent an existential threat to Iran. Don't you think if you're facing an existential threat and you're in the driver's seat, which the Iranians are, that don't you think they're going to drive a hard bargain? Don't you think they're going to try and get everything they can in terms of concessions from the United States? The answer, of course, is yes. So the idea that we can quickly solve this one and all we have to do is have a ceasefire or get the Americans to stop bombing Iran and then the Iranians will be happy, it's not a serious argument. We are in the deep, deep kimchi here. One cannot underestimate what a colossal blunder we made starting this war.
Well, there you have a good summary. How'd we get into it? The reasons they gave are all garbage and a big jumble. Now the most important thing is to reopen the Hormuz Strait, and we'll be coming to that. Don, anything?
Well, it's one of the people wonder about, why doesn't Iran want to negotiate? Well, as it's been presented, every time that there's negotiations, right in the middle of it, Israel and the United States attack Iran. These are untrustworthy people who are wanting Iran to negotiate. And so, as John Mearsheimer has just talked about, they have other ways to present and to pursue their own policies.
Obviously, I just showed you his Truth Social this morning. Well, it turns out that about 5 hours before that, this morning, Al Jazeera ran an interview with Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, and the whole issue of the ceasefire ironically came up before Trump's did.
We receive messages from the American side. Some are direct, and others come through our friends in the region. Wherever necessary, we respond to them. Therefore, there is currently no negotiation between us. Claims made in this regard are not correct. Our conditions for ending the war are clear. We do not accept a ceasefire. We are seeking an end to the war, not only in Iran, but across the entire region. We seek guarantees that such aggressions will not be repeated, as well as the payment of compensation for the extent of the damages inflicted on us and on the people of Iran.
So a couple of things I want to ask you about that exchange. Let's just start off, first of all, with here's Abbas Araghchi. I think the interview was done the previous night when it was done. So he's saying right there, there will be no ceasefire. That's not even on the table for us. And then yet this morning, here you have President Trump saying, they're begging me for a ceasefire, and I'll only do it if the Strait of Hormuz is opened up. I mean, just those that disconnect between what the two sides are saying within literally hours apart, what does that tell you?
This is madness. I don't know what else to say. President Trump just makes all these outrageous statements that you don't make if you're a rational, legal person. I'm kind of left speechless by the whole thing.
I've never seen this, by the way. That is pretty amazing.
What can you say? This goes on all the time. He just makes up these stories. He tells fairy tales. This is the president of the United States, the president of the most, the leader of the most powerful country on the planet. And when you see him acting like this, it's a cause for great concern.
All right, I'm going to skip ahead in the interview a little bit. Again, this is Daniel Davis interviewing Professor John Mearsheimer. And let me get to the next segment here.
And this same basic logic applies here. I just say one other thing to you, Danny. You know, you were asking me all these questions about President Trump and what I make of his outrageous comments, and I kind of don't know what to say. But let's just ask this question. When you listen to Pete Hegseth and Donald Trump, both of them, speak about the war in Iran and about foreign policy issues in general, and then you compare that with how the Iranian foreign minister, Mr. Arashi, speaks and how he reasons, who do you think is the real adult among those three? Who do you think is the person who really understands basic strategic logic and can talk about international politics in a coherent and thoughtful and impressive way? I think the answer is unequivocally clear. It's the Iranian foreign minister. And I think people all around the world, when they listen to President Trump and the Secretary of Defense or the Secretary of War speak, understand very quickly that U.S. leadership is basically bankrupt. And this is why we're in this desperate situation. Netanyahu, it's also Lindsey Graham.
Sorry about that. I was lining up the next. Let me see if I can recover that.
This is not only bad for the United States, it's bad for the world.
Yeah, that's a really concerning thing, but the evidence, unfortunately, completely corroborates your concern.
Okay, one last segment from Professor Mearsheimer, and we'll be hearing for some others. Talking about what our exit options are to get out of this mess, and they're not very good because neither the United States nor Trump is very eager about being humbled.
Have come to understand that this war has to be shut down, and we have to begin to prepare for that. And what we have to do is we have to have a story of victory, okay? So the argument that Netanyahu will be positioned to make is that Iran was an existential threat on February 27th. Today, when the war ends, it is no longer an existential threat. Mission accomplished. That's sort of one big dimension to this. The second dimension to this is, I think Israel is in real trouble. As I said to you before, the reports out of Israel are that 80% of the missiles are getting through, the Iranian missiles. And there's no evidence that the Iranians are running out of missiles. And this is beginning to look a lot like the June war of last year. Remember, the Israelis ran out of missiles then, or were running out of missiles. They didn't completely run out. And you're in a similar situation now. So unsurprisingly, the Israelis look like they're willing to go along, at least as best we can tell from the outside. But here's the question, Danny. If you, Danny Davis, are playing the Iranian side, are you going to be willing to let the Americans and the Israelis walk away, have a ceasefire, and allow them to reload the shotgun and come back after you 6 months from now or in a year?
Well, that's exactly what I was about to ask, because, I mean, let's just forget about 6 months to a year. How about 6 hours later? And whatever President Trump ends up saying tonight, we still have this to negotiate with. They're already making plans to formalize control of the Strait of Hormuz. So, I mean, this is not like the Red Sea situation with the Houthis last year, where President Trump got tired and said, well, all right, we're not going to, this isn't going to work out. Let's just declare victory and that they begged us for a ceasefire and we'll walk away. We won't shoot them. They won't shoot us. And that worked pretty much. This one isn't like that because of all the things that have happened here and the fact that they have control of the strait. And as you say, that they're one major flex or leverage over us. Why would they ever give that back? So paint some scenario to me, what Netanyahu and Trump could do collaborating tonight, whatever they may say, that's going to make it to where leaving Iran in control of the strait can somehow be twisted into a victory.
Well, we're in the realm of speculation because we don't know what the president's going to say.
Right.
But I think there's a lot of evidence that he's going to tell a two-part story. First is he's going to declare victory, or he's going to say we're on the verge of victory. And then the second thing he's going to do is he's going to say we're going to walk away. We're going to end our participation in the war. This is the end. And those are two separate issues. Just very important to understand that. The question is, can he tell a narrative about victory? Can Netanyahu tell a narrative about victory that convinces anyone but themselves? And maybe doesn't even convince themselves, okay? And then the second question is, can we walk away? And let's just talk about those two issues separately. Just first, let's focus on the victory narrative. As I said to you before, these two men stated very clearly before the war that they had a series of objectives. It was never clear which was number one, which was number two. They did bounce around, but it was clear that there were basically five big objectives, however you want to package them. One was regime change, two was ending nuclear enrichment, three was ending the ballistic missiles, four was supporting, ending support for the Houthis, Hamas, and Hezbollah. And fifth, maybe, is they were talking about wrecking Iran. They've achieved none of those objectives. And they're not on the verge of achieving any of those objectives. If you listen to Marco Rubio the other day, he said we had limited objectives. Number one is we wanted to destroy their air force, and that's what we did. We wanted to destroy their navy, and that's what we did. And third, we don't want them to have nuclear weapons, and they're not going to have nuclear weapons. You just sort of say to yourself, is this a serious argument? Who was talking about destroying their air force and their navy as an important military objective or political objective before the war? The answer is nobody, because it's not a big deal. Their military power doesn't revolve around their navy and their air force. And they didn't have a nuclear weapon before the war. They weren't pursuing a nuclear weapon. And the fact that they don't have a nuclear weapon now, a month later, is hardly surprising. But what's going on here, Danny, is they failed to achieve any of the major objectives that they put forward before February 28th. And furthermore, as I said to you, now the strait is closed. The strait is closed. And this has huge economic consequences. Furthermore, egregious damage has been done to the various Gulf states that are our allies.
And I'm sorry, I got some break.
That last point illustrates Kissinger's famous remark that to be an enemy of the United States or an adversary is dangerous, but to be a friend can be fatal.
Yes, and during that time when he was the national security advisor to then President Nixon, one of Nixon's ideas was to act crazy so that your enemies wouldn't know what to expect. And so it was, that was in North Korea in this case. And but I don't know that this is a conscious policy of Trump, but it's just his natural way of being in the world.
Yeah, crazy just we've got in spades. Okay, now we're going to hear from former Ambassador Chaz Freeman, who has a lot of experience in the Mideast and now retired from being an ambassador. He's being interviewed on Judge Napolitano, and they're going to play a couple of clips from him. Let's see here. Get the judge and Chaz Freeman on.
Hi, everyone. Judge Andrew Napolitano here for Judging Freedom. Today is Tuesday, March 31st, 2026. My dear friend, Ambassador Chaz Freeman, joins us now. Ambassador, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for these regular Tuesday mornings. They're informative and extremely helpful. Why do you suppose Trump is making up stories about productive negotiations with Iran 1 minute, and the next minute, often in the same statement, sometimes in the same sentence, threatening to bomb civilian structures there?
Well, I think he's and facing two audiences. The announcements of so-called negotiations, for which, by the way, there is no evidence at all. They may be entirely delusional. They may be entirely fake. There may be some discussions going on somewhere with somebody. We don't know whom. You know, we live in an age where everything is plausible and nothing is true. And he times these statements to the capital markets, to the stock market, very clearly. And he's been called out on that by the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, Mr. Alibaf, who's just said to Americans, look, this is market manipulation, it's not diplomacy. And, you know, we just have to discount it. But the other audience, of course, is Iran, and he's trying to show fierceness and resolve and so forth and so on. Pretty clearly, what he wants is something he can call victory, and then to get out. He's belatedly realized that this was a disaster.
So there again, speaking about the need for a victory, which seems pretty elusive at this point, but that's what Trump needs to get out of this mess. And about these alleged negotiations. You know, if you leave messages for somebody, you can leave messages. That's not a negotiation. And that's about the extent of what's happening. There was an excellent cartoon of Trump on the psychiatrist's couch, and the psychiatrist sitting next to him was asking, "And these Iranians you've been talking to, are they in a room with us now?"
You know, we've had John Mearsheimer on several weeks ago now, prescient, he could see right near the beginning of this U.S. war on Iran that there's no exit strategy and that Trump is just floundering around.
Yep, flailing and floundering because they thought the regime change, which was the number one goal initially, would be achieved. And, of course, it's a complete failure in that one. I'm going to return to Chaz Freeman being interviewed on Judge Napolitano.
At history. And I hope that I'm wrong, but I think the polls show that young Americans are turned off now by military or other patriotic service.
Here is that other clip of James Webb with Tucker Carlson. And interestingly, Ambassador, he uses the same word that you just used.
I want to mention that this is the grandson of a famous Republican politician was Secretary of Navy under Reagan and then served many terms in Congress. Okay, this is, and then his son was also a Marine, and this is the grandson, James Webb, who's making a bit of a statement about that kind of tradition.
Mercenary.
As of right now, I hate to say this. I love this country. I am not as proud of anything as I am as my service in the Marine Corps. But I will not let my kids join because of the way that we went to war with Iran. Because if you look at it philosophically, We have gone to war on behalf of another country to further their interests. That is, those are not my war. Those are not my words. The administration has said as much. Speaker of the House has said as much. And when that's the case, you know, you have reduced our military to effectively a mercenary force. And there's no honor in that. You know, it's this is an offensive war of choice.
No honor in being a mercenary force. This is an offensive war of choice. More intellectually honest than what we've heard from the president.
Well, I think he's on to the main point here, that this war was authorized by Benjamin Netanyahu, not by the U.S. Congress. It is in pursuit of Israeli interests, not American interests. Israel has a strategy. We were asked to provide a campaign plan. We don't have a strategy. And that's become very apparent now. And this is doing huge damage to us, to the global economy, to our relationships with others, to our military position in the Gulf, which is now insecure. I mean, one of Iran's clear objectives is to convince its neighbors that they cannot afford to harbor American forces on their territory without raising the threat of attack. And Iran is going nowhere. It's been there for 2,500 years. And those countries are going to have to live with that reality. And the reality that we are not only unable to defend them, but we are unwilling to defend them. We are interested in defending Israel and our own forces, of course, and we're not interested in giving them any kind of priority in resupply of munitions or in defense. And the worst example of that is our president's threat to knock out the desalination plants in Iran, which he imagines is central to the Iranian economy. Actually, desalinated water in Iran accounts for 2% of consumption. It's 90% in Kuwait. It's 80 to 90% in Qatar. It's 60 to 70% in Saudi Arabia and Oman. It's the same proportion in the United Arab Emirates. It's 90%, 80 to 90% in Bahrain. To threaten to take out the desalination plants in Iran, and which of course would generate a counterblow by Iran, and Iran has actually yesterday, I believe, attacked a desalination plant in Kuwait to demonstrate its willingness to make good on its threat to match any attack on its desalination with one of its own on these very, very vulnerable countries. They literally cannot exist without that water. And so the effect of Donald Trump's threat to Iran should be, or must be, to cause a lot of hard thinking in places like Riyadh and Manama and Kuwait and Doha and Abu Dhabi and Muscat. they need to be, as every country should, they should take their own interests first and give them priority. America first, but if you're Qatari, Qatar first.
That's Ambassador Chaz Freeman, and I want to just mention something before going on to another speaker, but a couple of people that I've listened to have commented on, and we commented last week on the insidious preaching of Christian and warlike Christian, if you can imagine that together, values in the military, and Hegseth gave the most repulsive prayer that I couldn't play it. It's just too disgusting. But if you want to read something similar that Mark Twain called out over 100 years ago, read his war prayer, where a similar militant Christianity was taking over our policy. Don, you got anything? I'm going to go on to Jeffrey Sachs on Judge Napolitano.
Yeah, why don't you do that?
All right. Jeffrey Sachs, well-known Columbia University professor, right, and with a great deal of international experience, interviewed with Judge Napolitano. Let me find the right starting point here.
why would the U.S. have failed so miserably to think through the impact of the bombings? Why could they so horribly miscalculate, thinking, oh, we'll kill the Ayatollah, we'll bomb some buildings in Tehran, and there'll be a spontaneous uprising, and liberal democracy will flourish? Is this the nonsense that Netanyahu and Mossad fed to Trump?
What we're seeing is a collapse of American governance. Not only the assertions of power by the president that he doesn't have, not only the unconstitutional order, but a collapse of thought. This is true not only in the instance of this war, it's true pretty much across the board. There is no thinking going on. Look at how the world was engaged in Trump's upheaval of the trading system in the past year, which produced a catastrophic end to job creation, did not touch the trade deficit, of course, because it's illogically unconnected, took $150 billion from the American people, and then was deemed to be simply illegal. Well, from the beginning, and we talked about it, none of those actions made any economic sense. They were without substance from a policy point of view. You had people of extraordinary ignorance pushing these policies. You did not have a process. There was no review. There was no public discussion. There was no congressional process and hearings to assess these issues. These were decisions made by Trump and a few incompetent people around them. So it wasn't only the assertion of non-constitutional or extra-constitutional authority. It was without a process that one would deem to be rational in any sense whatsoever or knowledgeable. If you think about this war, this is a war chosen by Trump, Hegseth, perhaps Witkoff and Kushner, who knows. This is not, from all that we know, a war based on deliberation, on the intelligence agency reports. Mr. Kent has made that very clear. So what we're seeing here is not only an unconstitutional assertion of power, we're seeing a complete and utter breakdown of competence, of normal process, even of rational review of options, discussions, and possible consequences. So I believe that this is not only a constitutional crisis, it's a crisis of the most minimal kinds of competence. I happen to be in China now and listen to proceedings about China's state of economic strategy. It is detailed. It is thorough. It is forward-looking. It is based on 2 years of systematic deliberation. I was with many of China's leading academics in the past day, top scholars, very brilliant people who have been part of detailed processes of review, debate, and deliberation. Whatever else one wants to say, the United States has no such process at all right now in any sphere of governance. We are not only in one person rule, we are not only in an end of our constitutional order, we are in a state of complete incompetence. And this is why the most basic points of what could happen day to day with the actions that are being ordered are not even being considered systematically. Or if objections are raised by the CIA or others, as was reported, or by the DNI, they're not taken into account by the small gang that is, I was going to say running things, but they're not running things. Things are running them. So this is why the most basic points are not even considered. And perhaps it's even worse than I'm saying. Perhaps the state of delusion of the president is even more extreme than we are considering right now. I don't know. I'm not guaranteeing that. But if it turns out that Trump's statements are false, then I think we have even another order of magnitude crisis on our hands that needs to be faced squarely.
It seems like Sachs lost a little bit of his former optimism. At least that was how I used to characterize him. But now he says it's as bad as you think and maybe even worse.
It was kind of interesting listening to Trump give this presidential talk last night. He has this, he's always going into, nobody has ever seen something like this. And he's kind of a low-key carnival barker trying to get people to come into his view of the world by giving it these extravagant overlays with how he is seeing things, whether it's attacking Iran or someone else that is going on. But he uses that mode of discussion often enough. Nobody has ever seen something like this before. This is the most important ever.
Yeah, well, he sounds like the adolescent that he is. We got one final bit of clips here, which is economist Michael Hudson, world-renowned, and he's out of the University of Kansas. A lot of experience. He's quite the senior economist and interviewed on the Glenn Decent Show.
Some countries will shift.
And I'll start right at the beginning, and then we'll jump ahead in a minute.
Well, it's the global economy, which is now based, obviously, on the foundation, which is no longer sustainable. The U.S. knows this is the case. Some countries try to adjust to new realities. Others are trying to delay. Others are trying to reverse what has happened. But this war against Iran, it really seems to intensify all these dangerous symptoms which we speak of. And it seems like the world can't really go back to the way it was after this war. I was wondering, how do you assess it? Because this war impacts the global economy on so many levels. Energy, obviously, fertilizers are key, but how do you see the ramifications of this war?
Well, we've discussed before how I think this is World War III, precisely because energy, fertilizer, and the other exports of oil-producing countries are so important for the entire world. That makes it a war that has worldwide implications. And despite the fact that in the last hour or two, the stock market in the U.S. has gone up 1,000 points, because they imagine that somehow what has happened is all reversed.
It's the global economy.
This isn't simply a war in Iran. This is a war that, as we've discussed, it's a war by the United States to maintain a choke point on the entire world economy by controlling oil, because everybody needs it. And the reason it went to war with Iran is the same reason why last month it went to war with Venezuela and kidnapped the president and took Venezuelan oil under U.S. control, so the United States can decide who will get this oil from Venezuela and who will get the money from the oil exports, the United States. Now, the United States, as I think we've discussed, realizes that in order to base its foreign policy on the ability to cut off oil shipments to the world, it has to, number one, prevent any other country's sovereignty from being able to export oil that's not under U.S. control. And so far, the United States has imposed sanctions, first on Iran, that remain in place, secondly, on Venezuela, which are now relieved, and finally on Russia. So that the only place where America's allies that agree to impose the sanctions on Russia can get their oil is from places that the United States controls. That's why the United States was so insistent in trying to, last week, on trying to control the Strait of Hormuz, through which much of the Saudi and OPEC oil is exported, apart from the Saudi pipeline. Well, Donald Trump apparently has listened to his military advisors that said, look, are any troops that we try to grab the Strait of Hormuz islands to control it are going to be sitting ducks. And this is not a defensible situation. And at any rate, Donald, don't you want to just grab the oil? And Donald Trump has said that, yes, the real aim that we're in Iran and have waged the war has nothing to do with Iran wanting to get an atom bomb, because it hasn't been trying to get an atom bomb. It has really nothing to do with Iran's foreign policy. It just wants American oil, just like it wanted to grab Iraq's oil and has grabbed Iraq's oil. So all of this this fight is an attempt to use oil and control of its exports in the same way that Donald Trump has used his tariff policy of saying, we will create chaos in your economies if you don't agree to follow what U.S. diplomats ask you to do in the form of what Trump called givebacks for his access to the U.S. economy by reducing tariffs to a less extreme level. Well, he's saying the same thing basically now. He wants to grab Iran's oil, and with that, he will complete the long attempt by the United States stretching for OPEC since, I guess, 2003 to take control all of the OPEC, the Arab monarchies' oil, and Iran was the last country of all of these, Iraq, Syria, Libya, the whole range of oil exporters. So now the United States alone is seeking control of the Near Eastern oil. Well, that's supposed to give it a stranglehold. The problem is that Iran is not going to allow itself to be conquered, even though it said that it's willing to permit oil exports again and to stop blocking them if other countries will supply its guarantee its security. What it means by security is, number one, removal permanently of all U.S. military bases in the Middle East. And, of course, the largest military base is Israel, which, of course, the United States is not going to do. Iran will also insist for its security that all of the sanctions that have been imposed by America's allies, by Europe, Japan, Korea, and others, be relieved. Until these sanctions are removed, until the United States removes its presence and, in effect, surrenders and admits that it's lost the war with Iran, the world is not going to go back to the way it was. And even if somehow miraculously the United States would say, all right, we've given up our foreign policy, we are no longer going to be the United States as an imperial power, we're going to be just another country following the rules of law that the United Nations lay down. You know, we're going to go back to a normal world. Even if it were to do this obviously impossible policy, the fact that the oil has been interrupted and the helium supplies that were coming out of the Middle East have been blown up. There are no cutters. Helium is already cut. And so the foreign companies that were obtaining helium before, certainly here in the United States, and throughout the world have all put cutbacks on helium. There are cutbacks on fertilizers. And although Iran is permitting oil exports through the Strait of Hormuz in payment for $2 million per ship, it's not permitting fertilizer exports. And so you're having the world going into the planting season. So no matter what happens, the world is going to be in the most serious depression since the Great Depression of the 1930s. No matter what happens, there is no way of avoiding this depression. And that's what's so crazy about the stock market and its recovery. It's as if somehow they can't come to terms with the fact that the actions taken by the United States and Israel are irreversible. Who's going to pay for the reparations to Iran for all of the damage done to make them whole? All of this is going to take probably at least the balance of this year to work out. So
I guess this whole program has been about how bleak the situation is, given the U.S. position. But as Hudson says, we're going to come to some humble admission that we've lost the war unless we want to blow everything up. I do have another short clip from Hudson, but I think we've run out of time. So, Don, do you want to add anything? I did want to get into the commodities business because listen to this quick summary. The Gulf is responsible as a source for one-third of the world's fertilizer, one-third of the helium, one-half of the sulfuric acid, which is essential for copper and other minerals transmuting. Natural gas, way down, one-fourth of global plastics, one-third of petroleum, 30% of LPG, 20% of jet fuel, 10% of diesel. So we'll be returning to the economic impact for sure in the future discussions.
And Michael Hudson really is one who he writes about imperialism and how a big picture look at the world, and he has, and how commodities fit into it, and that it is. Unless you understand how these things, which are going to affect, well, what's going to be already farmers in the U.S., they're trying to figure out what the heck they should plant with not having enough of the what they would like to have for inputs.
And with all these essential minerals and commodities being interrupted, we're going to have supply chain breakdowns, and supply chain breakdowns lead to defaults. So this, again, is what is going to be part of the global impact of the Gulf War.
So that's a situation where there's hardly anything that it seems that a democratic country can do to stop this.
If only we had a democratic country, we'd have a better chance.
As I was trying to point out, there's not much opposition in the Congress, and it's one thing leading to another. It's not going to be a pretty sight how to deal with all this. It's going to be carnage out about. And, well, this has been the Northern Sun Radio News today with Don Olson and Dave Gutnick. And upcoming next is Global Beat with Doug Kane.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
1986. Virginia Clemens loved roses. It seemed destined. Her middle name was Rose. She'd been born in Melrose, Minnesota, and she just loved the flowers, how they looked, how they smelled. But the multiple sclerosis she'd been battling for decades was making it harder to get outside and enjoy her favorite summer blossom. It just so happened that the 7 acres across from her house in St. Cloud came up for sale. Once upon a time, it had been an ice rink. But Virginia's husband, Bill, had other ideas for it. He bought the parcel, and the city of St. Cloud turned it into gardens, the Clemens Gardens, which included a formal garden, perennials, an arbor trellis, and a rose garden for Virginia. who only had to look out her front window to glory in the sight of thousands of rose blossoms.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at MN90.com.